What news organization did you work for?
I was the worst reporter that WDAY Fargo ever had. I sent very long network TV, not network, affiliate packages. I was a local reporter in Chico, which was KHSL. It was a CBS affiliate. WDAY was an ABC affiliate. And then I worked at an NBC and CBS affiliate in San Francisco off-air. Helped with news writing and interned for a long time.
And then where did you go from there?
And then I went to journalism school at Northwestern. I moved to Chicago. And then from there, I had a very, very brief TV career and then started working in politics in Sacramento.
What made you decide to switch from media?
You know, I was devastated. I remember being in Chico, up in Redding, California, and crying after I'd quit. But some of it was financial. I'd borrowed, I think, $80,000 to go to graduate school at Northwestern, and I was making $12,000 a year. Some of it was just this mounting anxiety that I was never going to dig my way out. Some of it was the stress of the job. I was a one-woman bureau, and so they fired the cameraman, and I was my own photographer, and I'd bring back blue video, and they'd send me out at 5:40 before the 6 o'clock news to reshoot it. And there was one time when they saw a network package of a reporter walking through flood. It was a time of terrible flooding, and they said, "Nicole, why don't you shoot a stand-up with showing your feet in the water?" And I said, "Yeah, that's a great idea, but I shoot my own." So I remember thinking, you know, this isn't for me. But I was really crushed to leave. It was because you do have a feeling when you leave journalism, when you've spent a long time being objective, and I'd never registered to vote under either party. I was always in California, declined to state. And when I left and kind of took on a party and all of its... at the time, I felt like it was baggage. Now it's baggage that I wear very proudly. But it was a real change.
And what job did you have?
I was the deputy communications director for the Assembly Republican Caucus in the legislature in California.
And where did you go from there? What kind of work did you do there?
It was just kind of press secretary 101. I worked in the super, super minority in the legislature. If you guys... all California politics, you know, there are dwindling numbers of elected. Actually, I think they're coming back now, but at the time I was there, there were 37 Republicans in the legislature, and I worked for a wonderful man who really believed that telling their story was important. So it's my first experience with kind of managing message for a large group.
And where'd you go from there?
Then I went to work for Dan Lundgren, who was running for governor. I worked for Dan Schneur, I worked for Sean Walsh, a lot of California political folks, and then I went to work for Jeb Bush as his press secretary. That was kind of the job that opened a lot of doors and opportunities.
Yeah, and the others, like Sean Walsh had been in Washington, and so
he'd come from Washington
Dan,
to, yeah.
So did you get a national sense from that?
From working for Jeb?
No, before that, from working with people like Sean Walsh and
I mean, they were real experts, and I always had tremendous mentors and people helping me and people that I absorbed things from, and I was always fascinated by the group. Leslie Goodman was there, too, a group of people that had worked in Washington that had gone to California to work for the governor.
When you went to work for Jeb Bush, did you find that... the kinds of issues that you dealt with were similar in the two states, or were they different?
Florida is like nowhere else, I think, in the country. I mean, you deal with Cuba policy, you deal with immigration in a real different way than you do in California. It's mostly border security. And in Miami, there are boats of refugees that come in. I mean, you deal with asylum issues, dealt with really different kinds of environmental issues with... I mean, it was really different, real different issues.
And then when did you go to Public Strategies, and how did you get
there? I worked for Mike McCurry at grassroots.com, which was his stint in a dot-com. And so I worked for Mike in between Governor Jeb Bush and President Bush.
What kinds of things did you do there?
Well, we were part of this startup, so it was... there were some parallels to the political world in that young, excited, interesting people that kind of worked around the clock. And it was part of this move toward moving political education and political communications online.
Mm-hmm. And what made you decide to come into the White House?
Well, I don't think anyone decides to come into the White House. I think an opportunity presents itself, and, and most people can't turn it down. And so I had worked for Jeb Bush, and so when the recount happened in Florida, I was on the ground, and the president's campaign, then Governor Bush, dispatched me to Palm Beach, and I was part of the team counting ballots and dealing with the hordes of press in Palm Beach.
Mm-hmm. And when you came into the White House, who hired you, and what kind of job were you given?
Hired by Tucker Eskew, who was the director of media affairs at the beginning of the first term, and he hired me as his deputy. And I think a lot of people thought, who is she and where did she come from? She wasn't on the campaign. She's never worked on the Hill. But he and I had worked together on the recount, and I think you see how other people, you know, work and function in a real stressful environment down there. And I'd met Ken Melman and Tucker and actually my fiance and a whole group of people that still kind of stick together inside the administration.
Is it, I guess that was an unusual circumstance. Sometimes it's difficult if people have not worked on a campaign and then come into the White House without that. But that, in a sense, was a campaign of its own.
Exactly.
What sorts of things did you do when you were in media affairs, both as a deputy and then running it? And can you tell people what kinds of tasks the office is assigned?
Sure. Especially at the beginning, and certainly to this day, the president, you know, reads the Dallas Morning News, and certainly as a governor, I think most governors appreciate and most successful governors have had a pretty good relationship with their state press corps. So he came into the White House really wanting a robust regional media operation, and the very first interviews he did as president, very first television interviews he did were with Spanish language media outlets who were also directed by the Media Affairs Office. And then the first print interviews he did were with regional newspapers from around the country. And we have always relied on the newspapers that people actually read. I think that the national papers are something that people spend a lot of time and energy dealing with. You know, some of the smartest reporters are there, but it's always been on balance with a lot of emphasis and time spent with local reporters.
But how do you deal with the situation that if you look in a local paper and you look at the national news component, it's by AP, Reuters, Washington Post, New York Times, those services.
A lot of it is, especially the foreign coverage, but all of the, at least all the papers in California have a reporter here in Washington, and the difference is they cover one story out of Washington a day. And they're not like the New York Times Bureau where there's someone that covers everything that happens. So I think it's actually really focused a lot of people at the White House on how to get the one guy that's here covering the Hill and covering the Congress and covering the White House and covering anyone from their state that comes here. I certainly haven't done that job for a North Dakota station when I was in journalism school. You know, I think it helps focus. You know, a presidential interview is a way to get that reporter to write about you for one day. I mean, we've been pretty creative with you understanding that a lot of the things that are in those papers are coming from wire services. You have to get the attention of the very small bureau, usually.
When you look at the interviews that the president has done, he's done over 200. I know in the first term, I think he did 208. I have not broken them down as to whether they're national or international. But have you looked at it as to how it breaks down?
I haven't, as far as the first term goes. I know in the campaign he did about 45 regional reporters before he did one national.
And what would be the difference in the kinds of things that the regionals would be interested
questions
in?
Questions are, I mean, it's a myth, I think, out there that a regional reporter isn't going to ask you a tough question about whatever happened on the ground in Iraq or the jobs numbers. That's not the case. I think the opportunity was really tied to our travel on the campaign. And we did a lot of these interviews when we were outside of Washington visiting a state, and that was how we really targeted our regional interviews.
In a campaign, do you do a lot more television? Is the mix?
We didn't. We did a lot. I don't think we did local television until the very, very end. We did a lot of local print. And the benefit was, you all know from this campaign, both sides were in the same states all the time, crisscrossing. And there were reporters that got so used to our call and our offer of an interview that they'd say, oh, gosh, Nicole, that's so nice, but I've got to go to my kid's soccer game. Can I get you on the next trip? I mean, they really got sick of seeing us. And, but it was nice. I mean, we had a nice rapport with a lot of these top political reporters in the states who came out and traveled with us and interviewed us a lot.
In addition to doing interviews with the president, what are some of the other things that you do within media affairs to get your message to a local area?
Media affairs started the first Spanish language, started translating the radio address into Spanish every week. Mm-hmm. For the first time, it was done intermittently before that. Media affairs runs all the radio. There are thousands of radio stations in the country, and a lot of people turn to radio before they turn to TV. I don't think there are more people turning to radio for their political news than newspapers, but there are definitely, in a lot of places, more people turning to radio than local TV. So the media affairs office runs the whole radio booking operation, deals with the regional television affiliate services, and also does all the local media around presidential travel. Things that wouldn't interest the national press, like a motorcade route or a visit to a candy shop or the local teacher that's participating in an event, is of great interest to the local media. So they deal with all those requests.
Well, let's see, when you headed media affairs, and not on the campaign, when it was just in a governing phase, was there a difference in the kinds of events that you tried to set up? Like, would you set up, say, policy events, like editorial boards, for example, to explain, say, the No Child Left Behind initiative?
Yeah, we did that, and the vice president spent a lot of time on some of the big pushes in the first term. We introduced an energy proposal. The vice president did a lot of regional editorial boards and regional interviews and a lot of radio. And it was, I think the point you're making was it around issues? Certainly, and around the budget and around the different issue pushes. We certainly organized regional media campaigns.
And who else would you use? Like, say, use the vice president. Who are some of the people?
Anybody that would. We used a lot of the senior staff. Secretary Carr, really generous with his time. Carl, Karen, Mary Madeline, Dan, the whole senior staff, and the cabinet now is. I mean, media affairs has kind of taken over, and the requests go cabinet wide.
Do you use the cabinet people as a way of bolstering maybe out in the countryside the president's case, so they don't do it from the White House itself, but rather they do a lot of these initiatives on the ground in California or in North Dakota or wherever?
Yeah, just a way to expand our bandwidth. I mean, every morning I think Secretary Snow does a half an hour of drive time radio at that time when people from Oregon to Virginia or in their cars driving to work. He does morning drive time radio. So, and different cabinet secretaries have different degrees of interest in doing it. But
do you kind of see who wants to do it?
Well, we ask all of them. Some are just, carve out more time.
It's interesting that as aggressive as you all have been in some ways in radio, like say with Secretary Snow and with talk radio, through the radio days that you set up at the White House, the president really has not favored radio. He does his Saturday radio address, but other than that, he doesn't really do much radio.
He hasn't done a ton of it. Yeah, it's something we'll look at.
Why is it?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think it's something that we look at. We look at it in the whole. I mean, we've done interviews with Sean Hannity, but they've typically been for his television show. The vice president does a lot of it. I mean, some of it too is balancing your different principles. First lady's done some of it. Mm-hmm. But we haven't done as much radio as we have TV and print.
When you're making decisions on who to use, how do you make those decisions? Who are the people that are in the room on that?
I think we're very cognizant of the team that has to travel with us and be with us all the time. I mean, we not that we favor, but we certainly give every consideration to the White House press corps, and he did two rounds of interviews, one around the inaugural and one around mm-hmm. State of the Union. And instead of doing a Bigfoot anchor interview as the only thing we did, we sat down with all of our correspondents and the people that come there every day and mm-hmm. you know, go to the briefing. And our print interviews are usually done the same, but we try to mix in. He just did a great interview with sports writers on the day that he threw out the first pitch. He's done interviews with outdoor magazines. He's done interviews with Runner's World. He's done interviews with Barbara Walters, because who doesn't love a Barbara Walters special? He's done interviews with, he does interviews with foreign television every time he goes on a trip, so that wherever he's going before he arrives, they hear from him, why he's coming, what his message is to the people. We don't do too much of this, but sometimes on trips he'll spend time off the record with our press corps too, just to kind of enlighten people about his thinking. Uh-huh. I think they did that on the last foreign trip.
In the campaign of the 60 stops in 60 days, mm-hmm. Which has involved a lot of people, mm-hmm. It's involved Secretary Snow mm-hmm. and Social Security people, Commerce, in addition to the President and Vice President. How was that whole campaign put together?
Well, after the State of the Union, where I think the president thought it was really an important moment for a president to put on the table ideas like raising the retirement age for Social Security and changing the way we calculate benefits, and something that's kind of obscure to most people. I mean, I'd never really studied or thought too much about Social Security before this last campaign. It was not a big issue, but a brief issue, enough that I felt like I had to figure it out. But I think we were cognizant early on of the need to bite off just what we could chew. And what the president thought it was important to spend 2 months explaining was telling people why there's a problem, why the finances are such that we're going to run out of money for people my age now before I retire. Uh-huh. So there was a campaign built around just accomplishing the goal of explaining why there's a problem with Social Security now and why anyone should care or pay attention to the possible solutions now.
When you develop a campaign like that, who are the people that are involved in developing it?
The policy people. I mean, I think one of the fundamental differences between campaign communications and White House communications is it's, as it should be, at a White House it's very driven by the policy formulation process. A campaign is, it's you know, driven by campaign strategy and campaign tactics. So the policy folks are very involved. The ledge folks are very involved because the goal of raising Social Security is to get a bill through the Congress. Uh-huh. The White House Communications Operation, which is our regional shop, myself, other folks that deal with TV booking and radio booking and all those components. Mm-hmm.
Would you also have, as part of that, Dan Bartlett and Karl Rove, with Karl Rove be involved in it too?
Yeah, I mean, more at the large strategic level, you know, what are we trying to accomplish legislatively?
Uh-huh. To what extent is, on any policy that you're dealing with, the communications is there as part of the discussion on that policy?
Well, I think Karen Hughes and Dan Bartlett and Mary Madeline made this so for hopefully this White House and the ones that follow, that communications is central and in the room and at the table for just about every discussion at the White House. And that was the case at the campaign, and I think it's an example that I think of the president understanding that communications isn't meant to sell a decision once it's been made. Your communications advisors are at the table to offer advice and help shape the decision-making process.
In what ways in discussing the communications of something has it come out that there are problems in the policy? Can you think of any instances of that?
Let me think about that one.
I know that there were examples of it in the Clinton administration, where Clinton was talking to his press people, and was talking about possible responses from reporters, because he knew he was going to get questions for a short Q&A, and he would ask, because it's even in that film, The Press Secretary, if you've seen that, in the discussion that he has, that he says, you know, how good is this policy, you know, if we have problems with it, that came out through communications, that communications becomes important because it forces you to think about an issue in another way.
Absolutely, and I'd say where the rubber meets the road is when you're putting together a message for the president. I mean, where the policy process kind of grinds to a halt and there's no more debate is when the speech is created. And I get to be very involved in the crafting of the speech messages, and it's amazing. You have these meetings and you think everyone agrees to a policy. So you write a speech and you put it into our process, which is called staffing, and then everyone wants to, oh, did we decide to do that? And so that is sometimes a way where I think the communications process really crystallizes and maybe pushes some of that policy process.
Have you talked to the president about communications and where he sees communications as a part of governing?
You know, involves you, and I'm sure Dan has mentioned this. At the very beginning, when I came back to the White House after doing the campaign and really thought I was done after the campaign, the campaign was grueling, and I felt like I had served my time, but I came back, and one of the first meetings that I was in the Oval Office, we had a conversation about the number of press conferences he'd done, and the number that his, and we told him about your historical data, and he could understand that President Clinton had done more than him. Yeah, I can see that. Couldn't believe his father had done more press conferences. And I think it brought out a little bit of a competitive streak. And what you've seen is the president really himself deciding to go out and do more. And the reality, I think, of the things we've taken on, Social Security, his real belief in the spread of freedom and democracy, require him to put his voice to these issues on a fairly frequent and regular basis. So I think it's something that he wanted to do more of, and something that he's very much a party to the decision to do more.
Yeah, because he has the opportunity to be a president. The press conferences went on the record in the Eisenhower administration, and since then presidents have had fewer press conferences in their second terms than their first. And so he has the
we may be trying to defy his
the record there. Well, have you noticed in the press conferences that he's had? He's had one every month since the election. Have you noticed a difference in the way those press conferences move by having them more frequently, both on his part and reporters' part?
Yeah, you know, the first one, it was January 27th. It was about my third week on the job. And even though I'd traveled all over on the campaign, it's still really different when you go back into the White House and in a role like this. And that first press conference, there was just an electricity in there. The reporters were really, they're right. You've all been into the briefing room. Have you all been into the briefing room? It's really small, and they're sitting much closer to him than you are to me. The first row is about here, and the chairs only go back about halfway, and it's really narrow. And, I think that really was a dynamic press conference. The second one was when he announced John Negroponte.
Right.
And it was in the in a larger conference room, even bigger than this. And I thought the president was real real animated, but the press was almost like they didn't have enough notice. They were a little flat. That one seemed different, but then the two after that have also seemed real. So I think the rhythm and what'll become hopefully the norm is a real, real dynamic and kind of electric back and forth. And he enjoys that, and I think. I won't speak for our press. I dare not do that. But I've heard that they enjoy having more opportunities to do that.
Yeah, because one of the things that seems to have happened is that reporters don't try to put six questions into one because they know they're going
to talk to him more.
Another opportunity to talk to him the following month.
Right.
So it seemed to level out some of that that frustration and make it a smoother kind of thing. You recently had a nighttime Eastern press conference, which are which some people think of as the standard, but in reality they're very rare. That only two presidents, Nixon and Reagan, had them regularly, and I think Clinton had four in 8 years. And what are the dynamics that go into the decision making there?
I think that we look at it as you don't get a lot of shots at asking for network time in prime time. Or not that you don't get a lot, I think that's it depends on events, but you want to make sure it's a big enough announcement and a key moment. And I think we felt like at the end of this 60-day effort, we really were ending one phase and beginning a new one. And the fast-changing events in the Mideast, there was kind of a moment there as well. And we'd thought about it for a while. It was not a last minute. And we'd kind of had it out there as a possibility for a while. And I think the most important thing that goes into it is the substance. Do we have enough to say, to speak to? I mean, I think that we are, as a White House, at our very, very best when the president is speaking directly to the American people in terms that they can understand about issues they care about. And I think the most important thing he ever said in the campaign was, you may not always agree with me, but you'll always know where I stand. I think he really believes that you all don't have to agree with everything he says, but if you don't understand where he stands and why he's doing what he's doing, that we haven't kind of held up our part of the deal. So I think that is personally important to all of us, that we've made clear why we're doing what we're doing, what the facts are. We've been up against a lot of disinformation on Social Security, so we wanted to use it as kind of a palate cleansing moment. And I think a real intense media focus on different ideas within our party without any focus on the Democratic Party. So those were kind of the different considerations.
Were you surprised at the amount of opposition that you've had as far as the use of the media is concerned in from the critics of the president's plans on personal accounts? I was thinking of the AARP, their ads and MoveOn.org.
I try to never be surprised anymore. I figure if I endured that campaign, I should be able to roll with the punches. No, I don't think anyone was surprised. I think we certainly had to redouble efforts. I mean, we had a very large echo chamber on the campaign. We'd been the primary messengers on Social Security, the president and the vice president. So I think we have had to, and we have done a lot of the communicating on our own.
Thinking about the campaign, how would you compare campaigning and governing as far as communications are concerned?
Somebody asked me this, and I said, you know, a campaign is like this great summer fling. You know, it's fantastic, and it's fun, and you stay out all night, and you know, drink wine on weeknight. I mean, you know, it's all those fun things, but you know it can't last. And governing is, you know, not the highs and lows and not as much drama. But it is, you know, probably a little more sustainable. It's, you know, maybe it's the marriage. the relationship analogy is true. But, you know, I just think, I think people that do what I do love the campaign, the kind of the fight, the back and forth. I think the reporters that cover politics love, you know, campaign narrative is very simple. It's every day you really, there is a winner and a loser. I mean, every day someone inches ahead of someone else, either in the rhetorical debate or in the polls or in their standing in the state or, you know, in the end it was, you know, the debates and the conventions. And I think that the press, you know, default setting is this kind of zero-sum, not zero-sum, but this kind of, you know, who's up and who's down. A lot of people call it the horse race. And I think that's what a campaign is. And so I think it kind of, I just think they're fun. And thank God they only happen every 4 years. So.
Well, you were saying they're winners and losers every day. That every day you have to think of whether you've gotten that much closer to your goal. How do you make that judgment? How do you decide?
On a campaign?
Yeah, whether you've won or lost that day.
Well, you want to turn on that network news. And you figure 10 million people are watching each of them, at least with the people that saw them, or, you know, you go through the morning papers, and there's usually someone that won the cycle or lost the cycle. Uh-huh. And I can think of only a handful of days where there isn't a clear. Karl Rove used to call at the end of every day around 8, not the end of every day, but after the network news, and say, did we win today? And, you know, I can't think of many times where I didn't have an answer. You really did have a feeling of either you're winning a day or losing a day.
And you do the network news. So and that's the three you're doing.
Yeah, and that's just kind of the last, I think, the last iteration of the cycle. And the cycle starts in the morning with the papers. And it starts with the five nationals. And then it started with about 30 regionals in key markets. And there were a lot of days where a bad story in a Wisconsin or a Pennsylvania was more troubling to us than something that was going on. But so it's about 30 regional papers and TV markets, five national papers in the morning.
What are the five?
They're different for everyone. The five that I read are the Post and the Times, you know, as soon as my eyes are open, I read those two. And then I read USA Today. Try to get through Wall Street Journal every day, and the Washington Times. I don't read some of the other ones that are considered part of that group for different people that make up their paper diet.
What are the major regionals?
Well, in the campaign, it was the Florida papers, so the Orlando Sentinel, St. Pete Times, Miami Herald, and then we were real focused on the Panhandle. So I didn't read those papers, but they were very closely monitored by the regional press folks. The papers in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa has fantastic political reporting. You know, it just depended on where we were traveling and where we were up and where we were down. I read the Oregon papers for a while, and then it became clear we weren't really in the game, so you kind of change it based on what was.
But everybody read everything in Ohio?
Everyone read everything in Ohio. Those poor reporters were so sick of us. And we would call them from Air Force One, and they would say, good God, you guys are killing me. Can you call later? And they were just, they're some of the best reporters in the country.
When you're looking at television, you're deciding whether you've won or lost. Do you look at...
just at the end of the day when you put together. Yeah. I don't want to say that television shaped our thoughts about whether we've won or lost.
But you look for, what are some of the things you look for to determine
you're
whether
very,
you've won,
and,
won
you
or
know,
lost?
You are very, I wouldn't say critical, but you look at the editorial comments of the reporters that are on the trail. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking to the reporters that flew around with John Kerry, a lot of time. And I think we took what evolved under George Stephanopoulos at Carville in the War Room. Isn't that the name of the movie that came out of the war? And took it to a whole new level. I mean, I think people will copy what the folks that ran the side of the campaign communications operation did for a long time. We started reaching out to the reporters covering the Democrats in September, almost more than a year before the campaign.
But do you measure it as well by just how much time the president has gotten where the public can see him?
Not by the last 5 months. You're on every night. I mean, by the end, there was a Bush package and a Kerry package. And so by the end, it's, how did each one fare? And I think I don't remember a period where we had a hard time getting covered. There was a period where the Kerry press folks complained to the cable outlets for not carrying Kerry's events. Mm-hmm. But if we weren't making news as a campaign, there were extraordinary world events going on, and mm-hmm. we never had that concern.
When you prepared for the debates, what kinds of things were you involved in the debate preparation?
No, I didn't actually prepare the president, but certainly in setting up how we would feed our press and uh-huh. and how we would respond. And the campaign communications operation had shared a lot of the White House press corps with the White House, obviously, sure. and then did a lot of work with the kind of national political press corps and the Kerry mm-hmm. press corps, frankly.
Would you decide what people might be good to bring out after the debate had occurred?
Absolutely.
And what kinds of people? What was your thinking?
Well, John McCain is the nation's political referee, and even if there were times where it was going to be risky that he might say, oh gosh, I don't agree with everything, his embrace of us was always extraordinarily valuable and appreciated. And I think the success of our convention was John McCain, Laura Bush, Rudy Giuliani, Arnold Schwarzenegger, people who in their own right had tremendous credibility and were perceived, and accurately so, as having their own judgments. And their embrace and endorsements were important at every moment when we had them. So they made it part of our uh-huh. debate response team. They were important.
So was the response team pretty much the same in each of those, each of the debates?
It moved around. We added and dropped people at some of the, I can't remember exactly who comprised each team, uh-huh. but yeah, largely. U.S. senators, and depending on what state the debate was in.
What kinds of mechanisms did you use to get a sense of how the president had done? And what were the strengths and weaknesses?
Of our system, of our monitoring system. The first debate, which I'm sure if you remember anything about it, you remember it as being when Kerry kind of came back to life. I think you had to be watching it. And my job that night was to write the one page of talking points that went everywhere that everybody kind of talked from. So I was listening but never looked up. So I had no idea that there were some body cues that people didn't think were real, people didn't feel good about. Uh-huh. So I think you had to be watching. But, I think debates are kind of the culmination of all this political theater that's been going on for months. And it's the first time that the two campaigns are face-to-face. And I think, you talk about perceptions in politics, this perception that campaigns are sworn enemies is, I think one of the things we were proudest of was that a lot of people in the Bush campaign, a lot of people in the Kerry campaign became friends. I mean, you sat closer than this and did interviews 7 days a week at ungodly hours of the day. And, when the cameras were on, you're advocating for your boss. But when they were off, it was, you getting any sleep, you doing okay. And people really were friends. And the debate was the first time that both campaigns were in the same room, swirling around the same place. So, I think there was a lot of kind of drama and uh-huh. theatrics there, but I think the response mission is the same, just greatly intensified.
Uh-huh. In looking at that first debate, I was watching it on C-SPAN.
And is it a split screen?
So I think C-SPAN was the only one that carried it split screen the mm-hmm. entire time. And so then I went and checked the other channels to see if they were doing split screen, because the split screen made an enormous
yeah.
difference. It really... It was very important. Had you tried to negotiate that?
I think it was in the contract that it was supposed to be from mm-hmm. one camera, but I don't think there's any enforcement of that.
Yeah. What is in that kind of situation where the president didn't look good in some ways?
People had feelings that were
yeah.
all over the map, but.
So how do you tell the president that?
Well, I think that I traveled with him Saturday after the debate.
Straws?
I didn't travel with him the day after. I was at Thrifty Car Rental trying to get myself back from Florida. But I traveled with them on Saturday, and, you know, we felt really good about, I mean, you, whenever you have an up or a down or a blip, and we were riding very high after our convention, and Kerry was on this downward spiral, and I think people saw him and saw him as a guy that could complete some, I mean, the bar was about here for him and about here for us, and some of that is expectations, and I think we felt like we had an issue that came out of it when he proposed a global test, and so we rode that, and you know, you just get yourself back on offense. I think that's what any White House and any campaign does. That's what any.
So does somebody have to go to the president and tell him what the various groups have?
You know what?
Have shown?
I mean, I think by that Sunday there were a slew of public opinion polls out where they're going to debate or not. He would have been aware of the polls, and I mean, we felt good about his performance and his debate effort, but. You know, I mean, it was obviously a point where the polls dipped for us and went up for him, and so we made adjustments and felt even better about the next two debates.
In looking at the, you know, you're talking about Democrats and Republicans together. If you look at the White Houses and how they're organized, you see real differences between how Democrats and Republicans organize their communications operations. What do you see as the differences between the two parties that makes a?
I don't know if it's two parties. I mean, I think Mike is an extraordinary person, and he was the press secretary, and he seemed to have, a little. I mean, they seemed to organize the office of the press secretary a little differently. I think media affairs was under the press office,
and
we just came in and organized ourselves a little differently. I don't know what went into the original strategy for the Clinton White House, why they pulled that in and under there. And frankly, I'm not sure exactly what considerations were made at the beginning of the first term. I know when we won re-election and we looked at, you know, how do we marry the best practices from the campaign, which obviously was successful, and the best practices from the White House, which obviously was very successful, we have made changes now. I mean, for the first time, we have a rapid response office. For the first time, the TV and radio booking are together under communications, and they've been in the press office for a while. I think when you win re-election and you're lucky enough to have a second term to get things to perfect some of the things from the first term, you do, you know, kind of take stock and I think try to pull in some of the best practices from different places.
What are some other things that are different in the second term?
We've consolidated some of the communicators that are all over different White House offices. Not all of them. I mean, NSC obviously has its own press operation, and CEQ does, but. The domestic policy communicators under communications, the faith-based communicators under communications, the NEC, obviously Social Security and Medicare and all the economic issues are front and center, so we've integrated economic communications.
So would that mean, like, if there's, CEA releases an annual report, the president's annual report on the economy? Is that something that you would go over?
Well, everyone goes over any document like that from the president. It goes through our process, which is called a staffing process. So everybody gets a stab at making it.
Because there were some issues that came.
Well, there was some brouhaha over an alleged missing chapter, but everybody sees every. I mean, the talking points don't go out with every White House office. Take a look at it. So certainly a report from the president from any office we get. From every office.
You go through it.
Yeah.
What are some other things that are different? Some adjustments
from coming off the campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. I mean, the summer fling is one way to think about it. You're getting off a treadmill, going 15 miles an hour, and you kind of stumble on the carpet is another way that I felt a little bit. It's just really different. I mean, a campaign is frantic and kind of madcap, and a White House is more civilized, and you know, things are more. I say this and people disagree, but I mean there are grave consequences. I was on TV sparring with anyone that would take me for 12 months, and you know, there's just a different weight of your words, I think, when you speak for the White House and and the president.
Right.
And so I just think there's a seriousness to everything. And I also think we bit off real tough stuff. You know, we went from a really exciting political contest to you know, one of those issues where you have to read every paragraph and every article to know what the heck this debate is about. So
one of the things about a campaign is that you're painting a picture each day, that your guy is the good guy and the opponent is the bad guy.
Not bad, just wrong.
And when you're governing, that what you have to do is try to bring about compromise. And do you see a shift when you come into a White House from off a campaign? Do you see that kind of shift in the way that issues and people are discussed?
Yeah, I mean, I think more things are the same than are different. But and I think on a campaign you're telling a story and you have a few punchlines that no matter what's happening that day, every story has to end with. It's, you know, whatever your three big themes are, and I think the White House can't do that. There are too many issues that come to the White House. You can't be as narrowly targeted on three big ideas. You know, I mean, every issue in the world comes to the doorstep of the White House. So I just think you're spread out across more issues, and they're very diverse. And yes, around big legislative pushes, you're trying to build consensus with a very reluctant minority party right now. And your own party that's a little, where they were wholly focused on helping you win re-election. Now they've got some of their own issues they're working on, and that's how it should be, and people have pretty realistic expectations, but it is a very different communications exercise.
In looking at your day, can you walk us through your day?
They're wonderful when they're out of the country. The days.
Except that you have to do nights, right?
No, not me. I mean, I imagine there are people that have to get up early, I guess, and do early mornings.
Right.
Well, I can't beat Dan Bartlett into the office to save my life. He's the counselor to the president, and he's a very early person. He's there, I think, between 6 and 6:30, and they're more toward the very end of 6:30, like between 6:30 and 6:40.
Will you have read papers?
No. Uh-huh. Sometimes I read them the night before, but I don't read them at my house. My house is sleeping when I leave. Uh-huh. But I get in, if I haven't read any the night before, I'll be in by 6:30 and try to read three before senior staff at 7:30. If I know that some of the morning anchors are out and are going to be calling, I'll try to back that up a little bit. Or certainly if I'm on a morning show, the whole day backs up about an hour, because you've got to have everything read before you're going on, and you lose that time. If I know anything's going to, if I have to work on a speech, or if anything's going to eat into that time, back it up a little bit. But most days, get there around 6:30 and read those three papers, read the Times, the Post, and the USA Today before a senior staff meeting. We come out of that, there's an 8 o'clock meeting that Dan and I have with our kind of division directors, and the press office is in there, and the NEC has been in there because of Social Security, and the regional media office has been in there, the NSC press office is in there. There are about 6 people in there. And then from there, a few days a week, we have an all communications meeting where we go and meet with every staffer in communications and really take about an hour to hear what's going on in their states and their regions. Because I remember when you're running that office, you don't want to bog down. I remember never wanting to bog down Karen or Dan with a story that I thought was a big deal in Miami but might not be a big deal to everyone. So we take at least 2 or 3 days a week to go through everybody's everything. And then as the day, you know, when the president's traveling domestically, lots of times I go on those trips and you work on the soundbite of the day or, you know, fine-tune the speech when you're on the road and talk to the press that travel. If I don't travel, lots of times there are meetings with members and communications, you know, gets to sit through all those. And so you hear the president talk about these issues in closed press meetings. And then a lot of policy time. I mean, he spends a lot of time in the policy process, and the communicators get to have a seat at the table and all that too. And then you kind of come out of your meeting rigors by about 4 or 5, start getting back to the email. By that time, any reporters that have called you are just apoplectic that you haven't returned their call yet. Some more than others. And so you try to, you know, make some quick return calls, and then you know, kind of try to watch all the news, and then again fine-tune any of the speeches for the next morning, and it all starts over.
One of the offices that's within communications, or was, is the Office of Global Communications. Mm-hmm. It seemed to rise and fall.
Well, Tucker Eskew, who hired me, actually was the first person to ever run that office when he came back from London during the...
What happened to it?
You know, I think the decision was made that even at the time, this office had to be created. This was an office that dealt with you know, journalists from media outlets from other countries and focused on America's image abroad. And I think that Secretary Rice believes this is a priority for the State Department. Karen Hughes is coming back to run that mission for the State Department. And I think that even when the office was created, it was acknowledged that if this were happening as maybe it could or should under the public diplomacy apparatus of the State Department, where hundreds of people are at work with this mission of public diplomacy, that the office wouldn't be necessary. But certainly having that office in White House Communications has sensitized everybody to the need for some of those communications to come from the White House, and that the State Department can't do it all. So I think you'll see more collaboration than before the office.
One of the unusual things about it is White House offices are usually just, you know, they just create them. You don't have executive orders, but that was created under an executive order, so to give it visibility. Well, let's go to some questions, and what we do is we take one from Towson, then one here, and go back and forth. Towson.
Could you expand just a little bit more on the differences in the structure of the press relations for the campaign versus the press relations and the communications at the White House, like just structure-wise?
Sure. You know, the campaign is a great multiplier for the White House, and the campaign had a two-pronged, you know, we were created, probably couldn't see anything that I draw, but if I were to diagram the campaign apparatus, I had a deputy that ran an entire communication shop devoted to shaping the stories about our opponent, you know, helping the reporters that flew around with Kerry understand his record, making sure they knew how many times he'd voted for higher taxes or a gas tax. I had an entire other branch of the apparatus that traveled with the president and went to campaign events and focused on the White House press corps. And then there was kind of a ribbon that wove both of those together that did all the regional communication strategy, but it was not implemented necessarily from headquarters. There were press secretaries in at least 40 states, and by the end in all 50. So the campaign was very decentralized and quite deferential to what was happening in the states. And it was also kind of held up by these two equally important missions. The White House, there's no, you know, opponent. We don't fly around with Senator Reid or, you know, you're not singularly focused on another press corps. You are, you know, it's kind of, it's more, I guess it's more linear. So Dan is at the top of the White House communications structure, and I function as the communications director and largely as his deputy. And then the different kind of communications apparatuses within the White House are the press office, the office of speech writing, the office of communications production is under communications, and the office of media affairs is under communications. So that's kind of how we're structured. And you know, like at the campaign, we didn't have an office of, we didn't have a robust office of speech writing. We had a speech writer. at the campaign, the press office and the communications apparatus were collapsed. At the White House, they're very separate, and Scott doesn't report to me or Dan. He's you know, an assistant to the president, reports directly to the president.
Mm-hmm. But he still is going to work the kinds of things that say that he'll be doing in the morning at the gaggle that he'll be talking about will be things that you all have talked about.
Oh, yeah. We're very coordinated. We just the head of speech writing and the head of the press office are their assistants to the president. They're at the highest levels. They report directly to Secretary Card and the president. But for operational purposes, it's all communications, and we're all very knit together. And sometimes I wonder if all the people weren't such good friends, and if there wasn't this civility that I'm convinced comes from all these nice people from Texas, you know, would there be times when it didn't all work out as well as it does? And I don't know the answer to that, but it's a good process. It works for the president, and it works for all of us, but I'm not sure it's a structure that will endure. As you said, it's real different from the last one.
Yeah, but if you look at Republican administrations, communications, there's always a communication structure, and that all the offices come within that structure.
Mm-hmm.
So the press office comes under communications, whereas in Democratic administrations, sometimes like in Carter, a lot of the time he didn't even have an office of communications.
Mm-hmm. We're planners, Republicans
that's right.
are.
Yeah, that's right. So you bring in a certain type of people, come into a White House, people who have management backgrounds, whereas Democrats bring in.
Well, most companies are organized that way, or they've got a VP of corporate communications, and that's the structure. So.
Here.
Britain, the parliamentary elections, it's really evident that there are stark differences between the communications here and communications in governments abroad. And I saw Blair on Question Time. I'm sure you know what that is. And, I guess my question is why do you think this is true, and if so, why? Do you think that American government has such a difficult time getting to that level of government accountability where the public is so directly connected with, I mean, they can sit there in the audience as citizen, ordinary citizens, and ask questions that are really intense questions that are asking for a real response, whereas it seems like in some ways the press conferences are much more cold and less personal and honest.
Well, I wouldn't, just to take up for my friends in the press corps, I wouldn't describe their probing of the president as cold or dishonest. I mean, they are, I think, take very seriously this obligation that not that many people go get to ask a question. And so this is the last way. I don't think any of them approach it as something to be cold or dishonest with. I mean, I think they all appreciate that opportunity. No, I mean, I hear what you're saying, though. I think there is a tradition in... I also think Tony Blair's role is different. I mean, the prime minister has a different role and different relationship, and some of that is born out of their country's constitutional structure.
As being head of government rather than head of state as well.
Right.
And the U.S. president's both.
Right. But it sure is a difference. Now, what I think is really striking is their press is very different, and this may lead to some of this. I mean, their newspapers are... Here there is our newspapers are all held up as and hold themselves up as fair, honest brokers of the information, and people can debate till they're blue in the face about whether papers are actually fair, but their stated mission and is understood to be hear the facts. It's very different in Great Britain. I mean, every paper, I think like 96% of the papers or 95% are affiliated with. Either are part of a party, or have very obvious left-right leanings. So I think their media is really different, and it is an interesting question, though. And there is an effort on our part to we do more off-the-record stops where it's not a planned stage event, where we just pop in and people can ask them questions, and we bring people into our events, and but. But it's tough to do, and I could see how you...
And part of it, too, can be what kind of responses you get.
Right.
And they're pushing and sometimes coming on in a hostile way, they figure has gotten them something that they wanted. But I noticed, you know, there was a big issue about the interview that an Irish reporter mm-hmm. had with President Bush, and in which she was pretty much in an attack mode. Mm-hmm. And so there were questions in the newspapers of whether the White House press corps should do more of that. But it seems to me that what you have to look at is what answers are you getting, and did that kind of approach get any better mm-hmm. answers? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem here the tradition has not been that gets you a better answer. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think. Probably the White House was upset about that particular interview.
Well, I think that the people that cover the White House every day have been on both sides. I mean, some of them have been there a while and have had real heated exchanges, and they've had opportunities to interview the president in a way that he's been more expansive. And I think everyone wants to interview someone who's more expansive. They tell you more. And so I think some of this is kind of the best practices on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Kelson?
I have one. You said you worked for Mike McCurry at one point early in your career?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm just curious, did that cause you any problems obtaining a job with the Bush White House?
I think it's probably... embarrassed him more than me. I told Rahm Emanuel that was my year in the KGB, and I learned all his secrets, and now I'm at the White House. I think he's one of the best people that has ever, ever, ever done any of these jobs ever. I think he taught people of both parties that you can love the enemy, the press, and the other party, and that's the way to do this job. And I admire him, you know, more than I could ever. Express.
But nobody asked you anything?
No, I mean, the president actually, on the campaign, when he joined the campaign, I was in a funk when he joined the Kerry campaign. For a week I said, oh, we're going to lose! You know, Mike McCurry joined! And the president even said, yeah, he's a great guy.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that helps him, don't tell anybody.
Going back to the press and what we just talked about, Adrian asked a question about why is it less straightforward. It is generally less straightforward here in the United States than it is in politics, than it is in Britain. For example, the president wouldn't think about going out, take questions from regular citizens. It just doesn't happen. Not necessarily that it's bad, it just doesn't happen. I mean, it just happened here that Professor Martha Gilmore asked you a question about why. Who tells the president about his body language or body cues? And the question was diverted, was not answered straightforwardly. That just happens normally. I mean, it happens all the time, but it's not to say that it's bad. It just happens. Why is that? My question is, why is it our politics less straightforward than it is, for example, in Britain or even in France or Germany, for that matter?
I'm not sure I'd hold up France and Germany as a model of straightforward. Maybe. I'm not sure. I think you can take a snapshot of anything and draw an unflattering comparison between any two things. I think that the evolution of blogs makes American politics more straightforward and spin-free. You can find a straightforward analysis of anything anywhere on the Internet. And I actually think we're at a point where there's more transparency in politics, the people in it. There are, you know, things written about me that, I mean, there's more transparency in politics now than I think there has ever been. On why I didn't answer the question, I don't personally talk too much about what I say to the president. So when you all have bosses, you'll have to decide how you talk about what you say to them in private. I've made my decision.
on blogs, do you? Yes, you know there is a lot more out there. But how do you sift? How do people?
But this is the beauty. I mean, we don't sift. The White House can't sift. You go get.
But what I'm saying is the public.
Oh, as a person, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of impact it has? Because there are a lot of things that are out there that are just dead wrong.
Right.
I mean, there's some things that are correct, but there are things that are wrong as well. And what kinds of hazards does that prevent for the average citizen trying to use it as an information
And the speed
source?
Of it, you know, I mean, so there's something about, you know, a paper like the New York Times, it's been decades and centuries in the making of its reputation. I think the blogosphere is moving in warp speed. There isn't time to, you know, develop as much of a relationship with some of your information mm-hmm. sources. So I think that's a...
I guess the concern I have is there's nobody... How do you authenticate that information? If something's in the New York Times, you have an editor that, series of editors that have gone through it. The reporter has had to explain where they got information from. If you have a blog, you can put anything up there that you want. But so much for my own concern about that.
Blogs.
Okay. Towson?
You just stated that you think that politics are more transparent now than they were before. What do you think is what could you attribute, I suppose, to the more transparency of politics?
I think it's what we were just talking about, that you can, if you don't like the level of detail that you get on the evening news, you think they're shilling for the incumbent or shilling for the other guy, whether you are coming to that conclusion from the right or the left, you can go get your own version of the day's events. And I think there are more sources of information out there and more competition. And I know a lot of my friends in the newspaper side of things feel almost trepidation that newspapers could go out of business. More and more people are consuming their information online. And I think the result of this is more an aggressive coverage of all institutions. It's not just government. Businesses are being, corporate America is being covered. There is a post-Enron dynamic with corporate America that's changed the way American corporations are covered. There is a new, I think, level of scrutiny and coverage of our relationships with foreign governments. I mean, I think all of this information being out there creates more competition and more places to go. And really, you know, you can choose. If you don't like the level of straightforwardness or a lack of it, you can get your news somewhere else. And I think that's probably good for people on both sides, the consumer and people on my side of this. I'm not sure it's good for some of the old structures of journalism, but...
Mm-hmm. During the campaign and now, what blogs would you look at?
I read mostly the news, you know, I read the Note on ABC, I read the CNN, I don't know if that counts as a blog because they email that out, but I didn't read, I was on the road a lot, and so I could get whatever was emailed to me, but I was not able to monitor a lot of stuff that broke.
Do you now?
I don't.
Do you,
Yeah. What I wanted to know is I have a friend in the White House press corps who keeps telling me that Helen Thomas hasn't been able to ask a question in 2 years, and that there are certain reporters that have a particular opinion, and so they're just ignored by President Bush, and that Karl Rove has a certain list of reporters that are going to get to ask questions for the day, and that President Bush calls on those reporters, and then he leaves a press conference. And I'm just wondering, what is the criteria for choosing a reporter to ask questions? And can you talk about the Jeff Gannon thing?
I think Helen asks questions every day in the gaggle and the briefing. I certainly read them in the transcripts, so I don't think that's right. Doesn't she ask questions?
She does. She asks them, and she has a chair in front. And
she asks questions every morning because I read them.
Yeah,
Helen,
right.
I'll get right back to you.
Right. It's at presidential press conferences that she has not been called on for some while.
I'm not sure what went into those decisions on the presidential press conferences. The people that cover us every day get the, I think there's some, isn't it historical that the wires could call?
The
you
wires.
Probably know more about this than I do. I don't.
Yeah. But I mean, there's the general protocol is the wires come first, and then five television, and then the major newspapers, and then from there,
if we
some
keep
magazine.
Going, we.
Yeah, right.
So she knows more about that process than I do. Jeff Gannon was from a blog, and we called on him once. These are the facts that I know. I know that there's been, we've all examined with Ron Hutchinson, the head of the White House Press Association, what is a journalist? There's I can't remember what his outlet is, fishbowl.com or this?
It was GOP USA was his first.
Was his,
one.
But then wasn't there another
then,
one after
there
that?
One
there was another blogger that came in. I mean, I don't. We're not in the business of deciding who's a. We're not going to define who's a journalist. I think that's something that journalism is working to figure out on their own. But that we wave in hundreds of people every week to come to the gaggle and briefing, and we check their Social Security number and their name and. And just about any journalist can come in. Medill School journalism reporters come in all the time. So.
Okay, Towson?
A practical question that's happening right now. What kind of procedures would your office do, say, in the case of Harry Reid and the filibusters?
What would our office do if they changed the rules in the Senate?
They're making the case. You're saying making the case?
Right, exactly.
Well, we put out a statement today, I think restating the president's position on his nominees, and you're probably familiar with our position. We believe that everyone we've nominated deserves an up or down vote on the floor of the Senate, and that if any of our nominees don't have the votes to be confirmed on the floor, we'll send up new ones. But we think that's a process that should go forward. It's, you know, 100-year history of the Senate, and we think it should be applied to our nominees. You're asking what preparations our office has made if this is enacted and the Senate shuts down?
I mean, there's talk about the nuclear option and changing the number to just a majority of 51,
right,
as far as cloture and that kind of thing. So.
Well, here's how we've tried to handle this issue. There's nothing the White House doesn't have a vote, obviously. This is something that would be decided by the Senate, Republican leaders. There's some Republicans that aren't going to. I mean, I know everything that I know about this mostly from watching the Sunday shows yesterday and reading about it, but the vice president has a different role, and he said that he will be up there and cast that tie-breaking vote. So it's obviously, as I said before, every issue in Washington comes to the White House. But as far as whether the Senate goes forward with the so-called, I think we're calling it the constitutional option, President's been real. We were joking this morning, senior staff, if that means that our nuclear energy plan is not a constitutional energy plan. But the peril in the White House getting too involved in something that the Senate has to figure out. Now, if this happens and moves forward, I imagine it will have a transformative dynamic, impact on the dynamic in Washington between the two parties, and we'll have to deal with that.
Get a question from here.
Hi. With the, growing transparency in the presidency, through the years, with the press being more thorough with their coverage and learning more and more about the president, not just in his public life but his private life, mm-hmm. My question is: are there issues that the president will address with the press, even though he's not the authority on them, and are there issues that the press won't cover with the president, like dealing with his own personal
mm-hmm.
issues?
That's an interesting question. There's a lot of history there, too.
Right, and do you define those boundaries?
I don't think we do. I think the press does. I've worked for elected officials who had whose families were kind of perceived as off limits by the press and at the state level. And this doesn't seem to be entirely the case at the White House. It mostly is. I mean, the president's daughters run the campaign, and by and large, I mean, they made clear that they desired a lot of privacy. I think for most politicians of both parties, that question centers around their families, you know, their kids and their families. And I think that question is kind of to the press. I mean, obviously, everyone in government and politics desires privacy. I think it's one of the hardest things you ask. That's something that I think more Democrats and Republicans agree on more quickly, this kind of complete loss of privacy, living in a fishbowl, living in a under this scrutiny. And I've never met or worked for anyone who wouldn't desire a little more privacy. But I think, you know, where those boundaries are and who draws them, I think that's a question. I mean, unfortunately or fortunately, we don't decide. But I've kind of experienced both sides of that. And I'm trying to think of an example where we felt like we wish there were more. Well, the president addressed it. I mean, he talked about how he doesn't email because, you know, every email he ever sent to his, you know, daughters or his mom or his dad, you know, he didn't want out there in the public sphere. And I think that's how he feels about it. But he's, I think every politician is pretty fiercely protective of their family's privacy and feels like they didn't run for office, I did. So, but that's an interesting question, who draws those boundaries and what are they? And I have to think that's back to the press to answer.
In the various places, you've worked in several states.
Mm-hmm.
Were the states fairly similar in the kinds of boundaries there were? And were they different than at the White House?
You know, I mean, I think a state press corps, at least in the two states where I worked, you know, has a history with someone. I think a national press corps doesn't get to know someone until they become a national figure. So I think when you arrive on the national scene, there's, I mean, I'm thinking of Howard Dean. I mean, there was a relationship that he had in the state where a lot of things were kind of left private. When he became the front runner in the Democrat primary, there was a whole different, the boundaries were totally different. They changed, you know, in an instant. And that, I can't imagine that was the Dean campaign's decision. You know, I think that's why senators, you know, a lot of them run for president because they've been national figures. Their states know a lot about them. And they've kind of tested those boundaries. And I think that's a little different for governors and people that come out of the states.
Mm-hmm. Towson?
What decision, when you were on the campaign, of what states to visit and what states to not visit?
I didn't hear
what it. States, during the campaign, what states did you visit, which ones did you not?
Gosh, in the beginning, there were only about 12 to 15 target states. Let's see if I can still name them. At the very beginning, Oregon and Washington were on the list. They dropped off. New Mexico, Nevada, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, Virginia dropped off, Michigan, New Hampshire. New Hampshire's beautiful, but they don't really get too excited to see us. That's 12. I know I'm leaving some off, and they're in that wonderful Midwest. Ohio.
Well, the big ones, of course, it's Ohio and Florida.
Ohio, most of Florida, Ohio.
How many times did you go to Ohio?
Oh, my God. I mean, so many. So many times. So many trips. We tried to be in a media market in the state every day. So between the president, the vice president, the first lady, Senator McCain, you know, Giuliani, I mean, we were in the state every day.
Uh-huh. How many basic media markets are there across the country?
Oh, probably that we targeted?
Yeah.
Probably 50 to 60.
And How many of those would you cover in a day? Was there a way
by
to cover?
By the end, every single one. Uh-huh. I'd say 6 months out, about half.
Uh-huh. How would you decide who to get out there?
We had this, you know, Ken Melman was the campaign manager, and if you guys, I mean, he's got like, well, I named him Rain Man, and I didn't ever do it in a derogatory way, but in the brilliant way that Rain Man could spill the toothpicks and know exactly how many are there, Ken Melman could tell you in an instant how many districts there are in every state and who should be, and so he organized us in a way that I don't think communications has ever been organized. We were organized around a very detailed, meticulously planned political strategy, and it was the first presidential campaign where the communicators came online the same time as the political operation, the polling and strategy operation that we all staffed up at the same time. Most of the time in presidential campaigns, your regional press office comes online about 6 months out from the general, uh-huh. or around a primary, they back uh-huh. into the primary. But it was very, very methodical, and there was a knitting up of paid and earned messages, that there was never an add up without earned media activity in the same market, uh-huh. so and or vice versa.
And earned media would you have?
Well, we unveiled a national ad about weapons systems that John Kerry had voted against funding for, and in the markets in the country where every single one of those weapons are built, there were press conferences with the member of Congress or the senator in that state talking about how if his vote had prevailed, the loss of the Bradley fighting vehicle in Ohio would have cost X number of jobs. So it was a pretty sophisticated overlay of national earned and paid and regional uh-huh. earned and paid messaging.
Yeah.
Exhausting, but it worked.
And that, you had that up for a good 6 months uh-huh. that you were covering all the different
by the time John Kerry emerged as the candidate, we were in full throttle down. So.
Did you have a research operation within your communications operation, or was it in a separate operation?
It was mostly run out of the RNC, and uh-huh. They had a brilliant operation run by Tim Griffin, who's over there now, and then we brought over one of his deputies, and so it was real closely integrated, but we worked very closely with the RNC. Uh-huh.
Get a question.
Mm-hmm. You keep mentioning Kerry's voting record. Do you think Bush was at an advantage for not having a long political career to fall back on and criticize, or I mean, is that important in campaigning?
Well, I think the Kerry campaign did a really good job exploiting the president's record. I think when you looked at places where they gained advantage, it was over his record. So I think that both sides, both parties, I think.
Because the legislative process is a lot more complicated than he didn't vote this way, but I mean, it's mm-hmm. every senator has votes they missed, mm-hmm. and so
yeah, a lot
it
of people
like
think
was,
that makes it hard for people to run, but they had a lot to work with. I mean, they did a good job.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think we've come to the end of our time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very
Thanks
much.
For having me.